these melodramatic movies.
Yeah.
Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to another exciting episode of Movie Geeks United, the biggest movie talk show on the internet. Tonight, the director of Toots, one of the most buzzed about and acclaimed documentaries of the year, Christy Jacobson. Plus, late-breaking news about exciting guests and topics throughout the month of September. Got a question for the geeks or tonight's guests? Give us a call at 718-508-9477. That's 718-508-9477. Dim the lights and grab the popcorn. It's time to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United this Wednesday evening, September 5th. My name is Jamie, and I am joined here by our co-host, Jerry.
Hey, what's up, everyone?
And Chris.
What is it, like your Carl Chiders imitation there?
Oh, that was my, that was a yummy sound, like in Young Frankenstein.
Ah, okay.
Make a yummy sound?
Mmm.
I didn't make a yummy sound.
Sing a little Putting on the Ritz for us.
Oh.
That's great. The number to dial is 718-508-9477 if you got anything to share with the geeks tonight. First half of the show is going to be pretty free form, and in the second half of the show we should be joined by Christy Jacobson, the director of the documentary film Toots, which is a great film. We look forward to speaking about that one. A couple of notes before we get started. As always, you can subscribe to our show by iTunes. The icon on the right-hand side of your screen, or just search Movie Geeks United in the iTunes search menu. It'll pull us up. It's absolutely free. You'll automatically get the latest downloaded podcasts from us and great guests, and we're going to be talking about that in just a little bit. We have a big announcement about probably the biggest guest we've had on the show so far, and he will be joining us. Oh, I let it slip that it's a he. Next Wednesday, a week from tonight. So we'll reveal that in just a little bit. So how have the past few days been for you guys?
They've been okay. How about for you, Chris?
It's been a little rainy. I've been a little busy, but I can't really complain too much. I guess that is complaining, what I just did. It's rainy. I don't want to sound like I'm complaining.
Well, you're not complaining. That's good. I mean, it's good. If you can't complain, that's good. I mean...
Okay. All right, then I can't complain.
Okay.
Have you had a chance to get to the theater yet? I know it's been so busy with the schooling and stuff for you, Chris, but...
No, I haven't, but it seems like all of my other schoolmates had a chance to go to the movies this weekend. They all went and saw Halloween and didn't invite me.
Well, that is why they will all fail.
Bloody rude of them.
Those sons of bitches, yeah. They went and saw Halloween, and they all loved it. All the people that I hang with, talk with at school, they seem to like it a lot. So,
good.
And they're just, you know, your average horror movie fans, and they enjoyed it a bunch, so...
Yeah.
I don't know what all this backlash, they seem to fall on you guys, on your side. They like it.
Interesting. I mean, when you go outside the mainstream press and things, the reviews have actually been quite favorable. I mean, I've read a couple of comments here and there that have been very negative. And not even so much where they seem to want to go after Rob Zombie, but I have to say, I mean, I am a fan of the original, but I read a good essay last week by one of our friends, Royce Clemens, who said, keep an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to do that, and I have to do that. I'm not always good about that, but for something like this, I was willing, I think, you know, after almost 30 years, a new interpretation, and one that is so respectful, I think, to the original, it works.
I think Rob Zombie is just, against all odds, he's become, like, a mainstream director. No one would have thought it, but he's obviously very talented. And if this movie had been made by anyone else, you know, some other, no offense to anyone, no-name director, just another in a series of Halloween movies, you got to wonder if it would have gotten that kind of backlash that it did. And I think it's because of Rob Zombie. I think you're right. They seem to be going after him.
Well, it's because of Rob Zombie that this Halloween is so high profile.
Yeah.
I mean, if it were billed as Halloween 9 with, you know, Steve Miner behind
the camera.
That's
the one that comes to mind.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. But Rob Zombie makes this a higher profile project, and one that would be a harder fall if it failed.
Yeah, I mean,
but it did not fail. It was the biggest biggest Labor Day opening in history, a 52% higher than the previous record holder, which I think was...
Transporter 2, I think.
Yeah, that David Strait, whatever.
Jason Statham, yeah.
Yeah, so that's significant. I mean, and it put the cap on what has become a record summer at the box office, $4 billion, the first $4 billion summer in the history of movies.
Yeah, it's amazing. We were talking about this earlier, but it's like Hollywood is desperate to, like, make that revenue part grow, but at the same time they're losing. Like, there's a lot of empty seats, but they've managed, because they've raised ticket prices over the last decade.
Yeah.
They've managed to, you know, they're trying to, how shall we say it, they're trying to stave off this inevitable collapse, I guess, of one day, not now, but the slow death of the going to the theater. My brother and I used to joke that basically the opening the movie in the theater these days is just a preview for the DVD.
Right.
Sometimes it's a month down the line, sometimes it's a week.
Well, you know what, I think that the studios are looking at that more and more,
are
taking that perspective as well. It's amazing, and I'm wondering how far we are from a movie ticket being the cost of a Broadway show.
Yeah.
It might turn out to be that kind of thing.
Well,
just to let everybody know, and hold that thought, Christina Klebe, the co-star of the new Halloween film that we've been discussing so much on the show recently, she was scheduled to appear tonight at the top of the hour. She just had a flight in from Rome. I think she was on the set of a new movie, and she lost her voice, so she will be back. She's rescheduled for this Sunday. She'll be with us at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. And the first half of that show will be an interview with Brian Garfield, who is the author of Death Sentence and Death Wish, and we'll get his take on those films. So as you were saying about this summer.
Yeah, well, I was now this is kind of related, and I want to throw this out to you guys, and maybe you can see where to go with this, but there was a very good article in the New York Times Magazine section on Sunday, an interview with Rick Rubin. And Rick Rubin's a very high-profile producer, has saved a lot of acts, reignited interest in a lot of people, specifically Johnny Cash with his American recordings.
The last Neil Diamond.
The last Neil Diamond.
Yeah.
He rescued Slayer from oblivion. He wrote Def Jam recordings. You know,
did great work with the Dixie Chicks.
That's awesome work. I mean, he's awesome in that documentary. But the thing, the thesis of the article is that he is the one man who might be able to save the music industry. He has his own ideas how to save it, because as we know, the recording industry, CD sales are almost non-existent.
Right.
And I was thinking, you know, the movie industry, although it's in denial, is going that route. And is there anyone, do you guys think, and this is going to happen, I mean, I think there's someone, I think Mark Cuban and his HDNet Films is trying to come up with a new delivery system.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think there's someone in the movie industry equivalent to Rick Rubin who can maybe create a new dynamic?
And for movies?
Yes.
I think Mark Cuban's idea will catch on. I think it might take a little while and a lot of failure.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of failure.
But I think that's probably the way it's going. You know what's interesting to me is that definitely the downloading has affected the music industry in a negative way. I don't see so much that it's done the same to movies. But I think studios are paying more and more attention to downloads.
They are.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that you're going to see a real investment in that technology in the future.
Morgan Freeman started that with that 10 Items or Less movie in the winter.
Yeah, whatever the name of his company was.
I forget. Sadly, it's on the top of my head. But there have been a couple people. There are a couple people in this industry, like Mark Cuban, I think maybe the Morgan Freeman. There's also someone like Barry Diller, who's very interested in new technology, and a lot of, you know, he might be someone who, I know he's thrown out ideas there, you know, over the years, but I was just thinking, is there anyone really of Rick Rubin's, how shall we say it, dynamic that can really, you know, try to jumpstart it? Because it is coming. I mean, I'm not going to say, like, it's the doom and gloom days just yet, but it is around the corner.
Well, Rick Rubin is a creative
individual.
Individual, yeah, and that's his position as mostly like a creative standpoint. I don't know if you see this change coming into movies from an executive or a creative person.
Yeah,
you know, the Soderbergh with Bubble Was that in conjunction with HDNet?
I think that was the first film. That was their first one.
I think that Soderbergh really believed in this kind of progression.
He believes in, I think he still does, and I think he believes he's open to, probably more so than any other mainstream filmmaker, although I have to correct myself there, maybe De Palma may be the one who's really open to it because he wants to put this movie on the net,
mm-hmm.
this redacted he wants to put on the internet and have it downloaded by everyone.
Well, it's basically a film inspired by everything that he found on the net.
Yeah, so, and I know there are a lot of filmmakers, it's like Hollywood's one of these places. The studio, at least the studios, I'm not talking about everyone, I don't want to make a blanket statement, but they are the studios, you know, they still cling to this idea of the theaters and everything, mm-hmm. and then the DVD revenue, but there's got to be, you know, we're dealing with this, they're the last to embrace the new technology, whatever that technology happens to be at the time, and I think this time with the internet, they really... you know, have to really just say, hey, look, this is the last days of the Roman Empire. What can we do to make movies an art form or whatever the platform is well into this century?
I think it's going to take a lot of ingenuity, and I think that, just like I said, at first these ideas for the general public will be kind of radical and crazy and ill-informed. But I think that they'll eventually catch on. I mean, the Mark Cubans of the world, I mean, they're kind of renegades. They're going to see their ideas and their dreams through. Mark Cuban is a guy that just dreams big.
Yes, he does.
And he's
I'm
got
very
the
impressed
resources.
With him.
Yeah, he's got the resources to follow through. I mean, I've read about his plans for his movie theaters, how he wants to revolutionize the exhibition industry. And it's pretty grandiose stuff.
But the whole the everything that we're talking about though, like the DVD window collapsing and all this kind of stuff, does it really matter though? I mean, what we're talking about movies like 10 Items or Less or Bubble. These are movies that have been released, you know, almost simultaneously.
No, that's a good point. That's a good point, Chris. Yeah,
they're kind of like testing the water with these sort of movies. But there's yet to be a major release that people really want to see, a product that people really desire.
I don't think you're going to see that soon.
I would like to see it just for what happens. I'd love to see, like, if you release, let's say, Shoot 'Em Up or something this Friday. But you had the option to go home, you could download it, or you could go buy it at Best Buy on DVD.
Well, you're looking at films that have followed this release pattern that are minimal risk.
Yeah.
You know, 10 Items or Less was basically made for the cost of 10 Items or Less. So
I like that movie. Oh.
I haven't seen it. I mean, I'm sure it's great. There are low-budget movies that are just spectacular, but... I don't think you're going to see, you know, a tentpole release.
No, you're not.
Soon.
And it's just
too
the way it's
risk.
Set up. I mean, there's just no way, no one wants to take, it's such an enormous risk.
Studios want what is proven. They want to follow the proven path. And so they're not going to risk their, you know, $200 million Spider-Man 4 on that kind of release.
Yeah, no, of course not. Or something like, well, let me ask you this. Let me throw this out. Remember... The Sicko was released on the internet like several weeks before it came out.
Right.
What
now? Leaked,
Sicko.
Yeah.
A Michael Moore film. I remember people were passing it around like all over like all the different blog sites and MySpace. You know, they were sending the film. You could watch it online. I felt uncomfortable doing it because I really wanted to see it in the theater, and I did. But do you think that might have... I know it's a small film, even though it's a Michael Moore film, it's still a small film. But do you think that might have hurt Sicko's profitability at the box office?
I think the release schedule is what hurt Sicko.
Okay.
I mean, Sicko still brought in about $24 million, which is good for documentary, but far shy of
Fahrenheit 9/11, yeah.
But I didn't quite get the release. It didn't seem to have the sustained word of mouth because it wasn't as much in the popular vernacular as a Fahrenheit was.
Right.
And so I thought they made a mistake in kind of rolling it out so slowly. I think they should have just gone for the big bucks on that weekend and counted the money and gone home.
Right. Now, let me ask you another question. Do you think that kind of release for that kind of film or some of these not like large films, but these mid-sized films like A Punch Drunk Love, you know how they'll release it in New York and Los Angeles for like a week or two,
right.
And then it gets the wider release. But a lot of people have already, or that limited release, and everyone who wants to see it generally goes out and sees it those first couple weeks, and when it goes wide, of course, it goes against, like, a Lord of the Rings or a big, big movie. So when it, or like Children of Men, even, when that goes wide, and they get demolished at the box office.
Yeah, I mean, I know their reasoning for opening in just a couple of major cities at the end of the year, because they, due to Academy Awards consideration, but a lot of times they'll release wide from those, you know, two cities on Christmas Day or during the new year. Is that what you're talking about? Like just opening up in New York and L.A. in December, is that what you're referring to? Are you there? Hey, Chris, are you there?
I'm here, but I don't think – I think that is what he's referring to. And I
think
don't
he's gone.
Yeah, I don't know where he went to. I'm sure he'll call back.
Yeah. But do you think that's what he was talking about?
I do think that's what he's talking about, but I also think that people – We kind of, in these conversations, we tend to lose sight of the fact that people are, they will either want to see something or they don't. Very rarely does the time that you release it truly have anything to do with it. I think that's really overrated. That's very rare that the release date of something actually has something to do with its ultimate grosses. It's whether or not it's been marketed well enough that people are aware of it and they want to see it.
Yeah, I mean, Jerry's back with us.
Yeah, I'm sorry. What happened? What happened?
I have no idea. I looked and you weren't there.
I know. I mean, I don't know. That was odd. Okay,
well,
sorry about that.
It reminded me of when I was like 5 and I got lost from my mother in the grocery store.
Oh, that happened to you too?
Yes.
Okay, I think it happened to all of us. Okay, all right. Well, I'm back. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, I just don't know. I think that by and large, people decide what they want to watch based on marketing, based on what's sold to them. I mean, because
do you still believe? Do you think that's even today? You think
based more on a sense of I should want to watch that,
right?
You know, and I think that when something is released at a time of year that's too inundated with similar product or too much product, I think certain movies can get lost in the shuffle. That normally, during a slow period where people are more attentive to, you know, that kind of thing, people would flock to.
Right. I don't think we're going to see a slow period for a long time until, like...
Well, generally, like, you know, generally, February, you know, the period before summer, like February.
Spring and early fall are, you know...
Not anymore, though. As each year goes on, they're done. I mean, we're talking, like, three or four or five major releases every week for the rest of the year.
Well, yeah, we're in award season in fall.
Well, not even award. I'm just talking about, it seems like, you know, what was generally, even like August, you know, August was the dumping ground for a lot of bombs, but they released a lot of big films this August. And January is insane of next year.
And summer's getting earlier and earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's tough. It's really tough to survive out there.
Yeah, it's hard out here for a pimp.
Yeah, it's hard for a pimp or a foreign film, baby. It's very hard.
but speaking of fall films, we have major indicators of what we should definitely be on the lookout for come fall, because thanks to Venice and now the Telluride Film Festivals. And Telluride's going on right now. Isn't that what you said, Jerry?
Yeah, that's going on right now, and... You know, like we were talking, Redacted is being shown there. Yesterday, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, and The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. And The Diving Bell and the Butterfly is a French-language film from Julien Schnabel. Please help me with the last name, because I always get his last name wrong.
You got it well enough.
Okay.
And a couple of those were big hits at Cannes.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a lot going on there. There's still a lot going on at Venice. And we have Toronto coming up, and we have the New York Film Festival at the end of the month.
Right, right.
With with the new Wes Anderson film, I think, is the opening night film.
Yeah. And then we have the AFI Festival.
Which has Lions for Lambs.
Yeah, they're premiering Lions for Lambs, the new Redford Cruz Street film. Talk about a prestige project, right?
Yes. You don't get much more prestige, and under the revitalized United Artists banner,
Yeah, the first the big project out of the gate for United Artists. The Tom Cruise controlled United Artists. So that's going to be a real interesting thing to track there, their success, because it's an exciting development. And
let me throw out something else, though. Speaking of two big fall films, one that opens this Friday and one that opens the end of the month, are Westerns.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about this a lot the last couple of weeks. Are we looking at another attempt to try to bring back the Western genre?
I think all it takes is a good film. I don't think the Westerns ever really die.
It doesn't die, because we keep going back and watching the old ones, and there are, every couple of years, there was a good Western a couple of years ago from Australia, which we talked about, The Proposition, probably one of the best I've seen in a long time. But you had The Assassination of Jesse James by The Coward,
which has gotten just raved.
Nothing short of masterpiece from everything I've read.
Yeah, yeah.
And this 310 to Yuma is getting, so far, very good early notices.
Yeah, and they say that it's good. 310 to Yuma is good, so I've heard, because it adheres to the simplicity of the Western. I mean, it doesn't feel the need to reinvent something that isn't broken, you know?
Right.
I think that's really one of the keys to the Western. It deals with the basic primal themes. And, I think that that's a tried and true formula when it's done with sincerity. And I think those films are the ones that come out every so often, and all of a sudden people talk about a resurgence of the Western. Never really went anywhere.
Yeah, that happened with Silverado and Pale Rider that summer, and then nothing until, like, Unforgiven.
Yeah, you just have to understand the genre.
Yeah, I think I would love to, and I know he's getting up there, and I don't know how much he has left, but I hope that when I'm Eastwood's age, I can still capable of doing what he's capable of doing. But there was talk a couple years ago that he was going to do another Western.
Right.
And I would love to see that. I mean, this guy really, he learned so much from Sergio Leone, so much from Don Siegel, and it's just amazing that he's so capable of still putting together these great movies, and I would love to see another Western.
I think he's interested in exploring other areas, as he's shown the past few years. I think he's really put his time in throughout his career in the Western form.
Yeah, but he does such a good job whenever he comes back to it.
Well, I think that Unforgiven was the last nail in the coffin. I thought it was the last. I think he made it clear that it's the last kind of statement he wanted to say in the Western form. I don't know that there's material that would bring him back.
True,
that he thinks that he can bring something new to.
I think he could bring something new. He seems to have a very good working relationship with Paul Haggis, and I wouldn't be surprised if they could come up with something between the two of them.
At the same time, he's exploring all these different genres. It seems like he's got something new to bring to every genre. So I kind of feel maybe like Jamie's right, like, he's at a point now where he doesn't really have to go back and prove anything else there. He can go off and do
He wants to explore, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all have our own opinions about his latest works of the past few years. I mean, I think I think he's a dynamite director. I question his judgment sometimes on the direction of some of these films.
The only one I wasn't crazy about was Bloodwork. That was probably the only thing he's done recently.
I'm talking about the fantastic films that he's done, like Mystic River and Million Dollar Baby. Just incredible films that fall apart for me in their last act, in the same way.
I could see where you could say that about definitely Mystic River.
I think, Chris, you feel the same way, don't you?
I do feel the same way, but I don't really chalk that up to his skills as a director. Those are kind of script issues.
No. I think it directly relates to his judgment, his story judgment.
Yeah, but that's kind of one of those places where I think directors get a little too much credit and screenwriters get a little get kind of shortchanged when it comes to things like that. Because those, and I know what you're talking about, and I do agree with you, both Mystic River and Million Dollar Baby, movies that completely had me for, you know, the first 3/4 of it, and then, you know, about by the third act, at the end of the third act, I'm going, what? Wait a minute, what? I feel betrayed. Like, I felt that way more about
Mystic River, I think, just because I was such a big fan of the book.
Yeah, but
you don't think that
Clint Eastwood, with his wealth of experience and his clout, could recognize that the third acts of these films fall apart and go off in a different direction?
Well,
and
you would think he would notice something like that, and I'm sure he does notice those things. But again, it's kind of what makes those movies unique, because they're both tragedies, and
right.
You can't really deny the fact that you and I, Jamie, are in the minority when it comes to those complaints about those movies. People love those movies, obviously. They get nominated and win awards all over the place. And they're both okay.
You guys aren't as much as a minority as you think.
I think that 75% of both of those movies are the best movies of the year. I think if they gave him the Oscar, they should have cut the head off the Oscar, giving him 75% of the Oscar.
Maybe a nickel-plated Oscar or something.
Because I want to share something with you guys. When you say that about, you know, you're being in a minority, actually, you may be more in a majority than you think. I overhear these conversations at the gym or in the market and people talking about, like, the films that critics rave about. And I guess the one that there are a lot of people did not like when it went wide or when they finally got around to seeing it was Little Miss Sunshine. And I've never heard so many people just bash this film.
Really? I thought I...
Really? I love it. I liked it. I have no beef with that film. But I'm just telling you what the everyday, I guess the non-film fan would say, you know, not your everyday moviegoer.
Right.
And just bashing it. And you hear that about some of these films that the critics rave about, and then you get to the everyman, every woman, and they're just like, I don't see what everyone's making a big deal about.
Yeah, but the people made that a success. By going back and seeing it because they ate it up.
Yeah,
I know what you're talking about, Jerry. But I don't think that Little Miss Sunshine. The people that I talk to love that movie. Loved it more than I did the first time I watched it.
I love it. I'm just telling you what I'm just hearing. That like people out in the street, you know, just my observations.
What street are you hanging out on?
What?
What street are you hanging out on?
Main Street, baby. More, you know, Main Street suburbia. You don't want to know.
Yeah. Chris, well, were you saying something? I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that it seems like the opposite to me. That movie was a movie that, you know, the critics all said, oh, it's good, it's great, but it was the audiences that really picked it up and made it into this phenomenon, and they really responded to the very simple tones of the movie, you know. That everyone
I think it's a beautiful film. I mean, very beautiful film. I was just kind of shocked, you know. I go here, you know, you go to these different corners, you know, very, you know, average, your average person, you know, renting the movie or something, and, you know, a coworker of mine just did not see what the big deal was.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I'm just telling you what I'm hearing on the street. You know, I'm not saying it's the word of God, you know, or anything like that.
You know, Little Miss Sunshine is built as it's a small movie.
Yeah,
that's the way it's built. So it can only hold so much praise before you kind of get jaded if you're watching it after being bombarded with word of mouth. I mean, it can't withstand all.
No, that's true. And I think that's true with the two Eastwood movies you're talking about too. By the, you know, when they filter on down, when you get past the releases, you know, the theatrical runs, people watch them on cable, and you do hear this. I hear this, you know, time and time again. Not just with these movies. I'm talking about older movies too that we hold up to on a very high standard. People are just like, you know, I talk to people, they just, I don't see the big deal. What was so great about it?
Yeah, I mean, Eastwood is the one that killed my expectations for those movies, not the audience, because he had me in the palm of his hand, you know,
right.
2 hours out of
it. Well, he always has me in the palm of his hand, so not for Absolute Power or Bloodwork, but, you know, he usually has me.
I find all of his movies, you know, entertaining. I mean, there are different levels of you know, craft involved in each one, but you know, all of them are pretty entertaining. They have great performers that sign up because they want to work with Eastwood. You know, he's a very confident, capable, no BS guy.
Oh, he's. I don't think there's anyone else quite like him. He's been around. He's been lucky enough to work with so many people and been around for, you know, the last a good chunk of the last century. Half the century, and now this one, and he's still turning out, I think, good work. But yeah, the issues that you guys are bringing up, you're not in a minority as much as you think. I hear this a lot about those two movies. The third act of both those movies throw people off.
Yeah,
they really just people do not. There's something happens. They're like, yeah, it's great up until, and then boom, it's like a switch or something, and people are just like, you know, what happened?
Yeah.
It's not even like it's an odd choice that's made in both of those movies. It's like a truly a thematic betrayal almost, I feel, especially
I feel
in Mystic
way.
River.
Yeah.
It just really betrays the themes of the movie that I had been feeling all along, you know, for the past 2 hours. And then they just take this turn that sours what everything I've just seen. It
right.
gives the movie a completely different message. More so in Mystic River, I think. Million Dollar Baby I can kind of go along with more. But Mystic River just really
maybe.
And so that I never wanted to see it again.
Yeah, and when I sat down for... And I've seen Mystic River several times, and the same with Million Dollar Baby. My approach to Million Dollar Baby was not in any way political. I don't have any kind of... I don't sway either way in terms of euthanasia or assisted suicide.
Yeah, it's amazing how that came about.
Yeah, I don't. It wasn't based on that. It was just based on the concept that you'd follow these characters this far, and the end of that movie for me betrayed the journey of these characters. I thought that she was without someone to love her whole life or without anyone that really loved her. I thought she found that in Eastwood. That was very well established.
Yeah.
And the same holds for Eastwood. And for that to occur at the end of it, for her to feel like there's nothing else to live for when she found something that she had been lacking and had suffered because of her whole life, I thought it was a betrayal of that character. And the same with Mystic River. I didn't know what the hell I was watching the last 10, 15 minutes of Mystic River. I was like, what is this movie I've been about? Sean Penn and Laura Linney are having some kind of Shakespearean conversation, like King Lear-inspired conversation at the end of it, and it just felt awkward. It felt odd, like I was watching a different movie. It wasn't consistent with the tone and, like Chris said, the themes of that film.
Right.
So that's my take on Eastwood.
Well, that's a very those for those two movies though. I hear that a lot, so I think it's good that you guys bring that up because that is something I hear all the time.
What's funny to
me
is, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, how about Space Cowboys? Let's debate it.
I thought that was the first thing I'd seen from him in a long time that I enjoyed.
I thought that Donald Sutherland's bare ass was completely out of line with the.
I thought the last image of that movie. Wow.
Yeah, talk about assisted suicide.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed that movie. I have no beef with that movie. That was a lot of fun, because that was a bad summer for movies, and especially, so that was a nice relief to see that.
It was fun. Wasn't it like 2.5 hours?
I don't know if it was that long, but
it was a long
great
movie.
Yeah, it reminded me of, like, if Kevin Costner had directed Space Cowboys.
Oh, God, if Kevin Costner had directed Space Cowboys, he would not have made any movie after that.
We keep saying that. Everyone keeps saying that. He's never going to make a movie again.
Oh, he keeps doing it.
He keeps doing us that favor.
And he keeps putting his money where his mouth is, too. I mean, he's financing he financed for a large chunk of Mr. Brooks, and he's financing his latest movie, Swing Vote, which sounds like a winner, actually. A political comedy, so.
Well, Mr. Brooks was a nice change of pace for him, so, if he's going to do more films like that, he's got my vote.
Yeah. Now, what's funny to me is how there's an article in Entertainment Weekly questioning whether or not Clint Eastwood will ever act again.
He has no interest, really, though.
Well, but he says, on the other hand, never say never, but I think it's funny. I mean, he acted in Million Dollar Baby.
He wasn't eager to do that. Didn't someone beg him to?
I don't know.
Because he said after Blood Work he wouldn't do it. He said, audiences don't want to see me. So that's when Mr.
I think it's an impressive performance, actually.
Yeah, but he said, I know, I'm glad he did it. But I'm just, after Blood Work, he said, obviously people don't want to see me act, so I'm not going to act anymore. And that was true with Mystic River, but then he did, Million Dollar Baby, and he acts again. But
right. It looks as though Christy Jacobson has not called in yet, and probably will not, I would imagine.
Bummer.
We confirmed with her management several times, and they actually requested this date and this segment. Unfortunately, our segments for the next week and a half or so are all full, so we'll try to bring her back on at a future date, because this is a good film, and I'm really anxious to discuss it with her. but we'll get her on some other time. As for our future guests, are you guys ready?
I've been ready, man.
Okay. This Sunday, like I said, Brian Garfield of Death Sentence, the author of Death Sentence and Death Wish, and Christina Klebe, co-star of the new Halloween film. She plays Linda. I don't want to give anything away, but she's got a nice gruesome death scene. next Wednesday, we're working on right now, not necessarily for next Wednesday, but in the future, there's this horror film called Hatchet. Have you guys heard of it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's getting a lot of good advanced buzz, and we're following that, and we want to bring on some talent from that film. We're currently working on that. And the first half of next Wednesday's show will be dedicated to a film called Canvas. It opens up in mid-October. And it's a great, heartwarming little movie, and it deserves the biggest audience it can get. It's about a family struggling through schizophrenia. It stars Marcia Gay Harden and Joe Pantoliano, Joey Pants. And it's directed by Joseph Greco, which Joseph Greco, actually, I think this is his first directorial feature. Prior to this, he worked on Titanic with James Cameron. So that's an interesting story right there we're going to have to get, because we have Joseph Greco on their show Wednesday, as well as, are you guys ready for a drum roll? Hang on.
Yeah.
Hang on. I actually downloaded a drum roll sound effect. You guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just I got it here.
The sound effect or the guest?
Both.
All right, here we go. We have... That was loud. We have Joe Pantoliano on the show Wednesday.
Cousin Ralphie!
That's right. He's such an incredible, remarkable actor. He's got such a resume, man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better one. My God.
Ralphie and Sopranos, The Matrix, Bound, Midnight Run, Empire of the Sun. I mean, the people that this man has worked with and the films that he's contributed great performances to are just staggering. So a big guest next Wednesday, and it'll be a roundtable discussion on the film Canvas with the director and star Joe Pantoliano.
That's awesome. And remember, you interviewed Marcia Gay Harden, too.
I got a question in, yeah.
Yes, you did. Hey, that counts. I mean...
Yeah. I got the most generic question out of my mouth that I could think of in such a short advance notice, you know. I didn't know that I was going to be able to interview her, so I just said the first thing that came to mind, which was, you know, why did you choose to do this movie? It wasn't incredibly, you know, ingenious or thoughtful, but, you know, what do you want?
Hey, he's better than nothing, you know? I mean, it could have been worse.
It could have been. What kind of other embarrassing questions could I have asked of her?
Well, you could ask, like, so, you know, what was it like working with Albert Finney and Gabriel Byrne and, like, Miller's Crossing? You know, could you keep up with Albert Finney?
She's in the press line. She's trying to get through the press line to walk into the screening of her upcoming film, Canvas. It opens in 6 months. So she gets through the press line. I'm at the very end. She's here for this big premiere of Canvas. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's asking her about it. She comes up to me and I say, what was it like working with Albert Finney at Miller's Crossing?
You could ask her that. You could ask her what kind of, like, you know, was she, you know, intoxicated when she signed the contract for the movie The Invisible, or, you know, anything? I mean, just a lot of random bullshit questions. I mean, I'm just saying, you know?
Yeah, she's great. Actually, she looks like she's going to contribute a great performance in that movie, The Mist, the new Stephen King.
Yeah, oh, that looks really good.
It does, Frank Darabont.
Yeah, that will be a good film.
Yeah. Chris, are you still with us?
I am still with us. Yes.
Have you seen any interesting trailers yet for the upcoming releases?
I saw the Mist trailer yesterday, actually, and I have to agree. I like both Darabont's movies, his Stephen King movies, that is.
Yeah.
I can't say the same thing about The Majestic, but I'm glad that he's getting back to Stephen King, and this time a horror movie, so it'll be interesting to see what he can do with that. And he's such a good writer, too.
Yeah, he really is.
Yeah.
I'm so interested in reading his Indiana Jones script.
Yeah, what was wrong with it that they had to you've got to ask yourself, what was wrong with that script?
George Lucas was wrong with it.
I know, I realize that. Hey, there are people acting in this. This is real dialogue. I can't have this.
You know, I guarantee you that you will still see Darabont's fingerprints on the finished product.
I think you're going to see, do you want to know the honest truth? You're going to see fingerprints from the time that script, that when it was Jeffrey Boehm, I think, wrote it, and who's the other guy, Jeff Nathanson? Is Jeff Nathanson writing it now?
Isn't it a David Koepp?
It might be, okay, David, I think you're going to have, there's so many screenwriters that have been attached to that for, like, the last 15 years.
Yeah, all very good screenwriters.
Yeah,
but,
excellent,
you know,
screenwriters. You're going to see, I think, ideas from all those scripts.
Darabont even said, you know, bringing back Marianne was my idea.
Well, that was a smart idea to bring
Darabont is very sour about this.
I would be, too.
Because Ford and Spielberg were sold on his script, and then George Lucas kind of vetoed it. It'll be interesting to hear the final story on that. I know that Darabont has been vocal in his criticism of that choice. But,
he's even said that he's done writing scripts for hire, too. He's done with it, because that's what he's been doing for the past 20 years or so. He's been hired to do scripts for other people, and he doesn't want to do it anymore. I can't help but think that this was the final straw.
I would be the guy who invented Jar Jar Binks pulls my script. I'd be pissed off too.
Right.
The guy, don't get me wrong, I we've talked about Lucas before, he's an awesome idea man, he's responsible for, you know, one of the great trilogies of our time, but you don't, Frank Darabont's a, you know, an established talent, someone who has a proven track record. I wouldn't, like, pull his script. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shame. And but with The Mist, it looks like Darabont, you know, of course it's an all-out horror movie, and he says he was interested in making a fun, you know, balls-to-the-wall horror film. But he also brought out the human drama. You could tell that really interested him too, the isolation of all of those people joined in fear in that supermarket.
Oh, yeah.
It is. I think that's really the main sell of that material for him. And he brings that out of Stephen King's work more so than anyone else that works with King's.
I think what he's done with King's stuff is phenomenal. The Shawshank Redemption, for me at least, came out of nowhere when that opened. I just saw a trailer for it, I think, on E!
Right.
And with my mom, and I just like, wow, that looks really good, and I went to go see it, and I was just really blown away by that film. And I was like, God, that's been, what has it been, 13 years now? My God.
Wow. That's, I remember people walking, there's
another,
go ahead.
All right, and another fantastic trailer that's out, looks like it's going to be a really powerful movie, is Grace Is Gone.
Oh, yeah.
John Cusack.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen this preview yet?
I just watched it a couple of nights ago, yeah.
And it's funny you guys bring that up, because Eastwood's doing the music for that.
Really?
Is he really?
Yes. I'm not making that up. I'm not trying to be... there's a big thing that he's doing the music for it, and that all of a sudden, because of this, because of the music, they're saying, well, the movie will at least get an Oscar nomination for music.
Right. Well, John Cusack, I read an interview with him, and he said that he desperately wanted to do a film dealing in some way with Iraq. And even if he had to write it himself, he was going to do it. And about that time, he received the script of Grace Is Gone. So it was almost like Serendipity, which, incidentally, is another John Cusack movie. And
I agree with him. He's absolutely right.
And he's fantastic. And I think this is probably the role that will finally get him the recognition he deserves as being a great actor. Yeah.
I always thought he earned that with The Grifters.
It's always been kind of understood around people that appreciate that sort of thing. But it hasn't by the establishment, and I don't think, you know, the public at large.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But I was really blown away by his performance in The Grifters.
Speaking of composers, did you hear that John Ottman is no longer composing Valkyrie?
What happened?
They went with another composer.
Wow.
Yes. As you know, we spoke to him a month and a half or so ago. And it might be due to the fact that, you know, he's editing this massive film. And if they want the score at the time they want it and at the level that they want it, then it was probably a suggestion on his part.
Okay.
That would be my take on it. A lot of people are writing it like he was fired from scoring the film, but I don't believe that.
Yeah, I don't think it's something where he. I think it sounds like maybe it was just like you said, too much to take on, and.
Yeah. There is a new group photo of the cast.
Yeah, I was reading about that today.
Yeah, it's interesting. Tom Cruise with the eye patch and everything, and then you see, what's his name, that wonderful actor, Bill Nye.
Bill Nye, Terrence Stamp, and
Terrence Stamp.
Branagh.
That's right. That's yeah.
Kenneth Branagh. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's gonna be a big deal. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, we were actually, and Brian Singer, he's doing a different movie after Valkyrie. He's doing what's he been talking about?
The Mayor of Castro Street, isn't that?
Yes.
Logan's Run story. He's been trying to do Logan's Run for a long time.
He's going
to
do that, I think, finally. He's been talking about Logan's Run ever since The Usual Suspects came out.
Right.
Yeah.
He's been wanting to do this, and I think he is going to do that, but I think even longer in gestation is the Harvey Milk film, The Mayor of Castro Street, which Gus Van Sant, I remember, was originally attached to do at one time. And that's something, that's one of those projects, that's just been in development hell. And Logan's Run's the same way, but he still has to do Superman, the second Superman movie.
That's the thing with Superman, because I was discussing this with Tiffany the other night, because she just recently saw it. And, a lackluster movie, surprisingly lackluster, because, just consider what he did with X-Men. And he's even crazier about Superman.
So much so that he jumped off the X-Men ship.
Yeah, and so he's promised a more action-packed and fan-friendly sequel to Superman, but it's really taken the back burner on his to-do list, it seems.
It's taken the back burner on everyone else's to-do list too, because I don't think anybody wants. I've never been a big Superman fan. I've always been a Marvel guy, comic book geek, and
I'm the same way. But Marvel movies until X-Men weren't that.
Right.
That great.
And in my opinion, the best comic book movie is Batman Begins, which is a DC movie. And I was never a big fan of Superman movies. But I was even excited about this Superman movie that came out.
Likewise.
Because Bryan Singer was involved, and
right.
because
yeah.
Faith was involved, and it looked like a really good project. And I watched it for a second time just the other night also on HBO, and it's shocking how dull that movie is.
And parts of that movie are, there's some parts I think that are actually are good, but on the whole, the movie is lackluster, as Jamie said.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh, it's just so dull.
How much of that has to do with the character of Superman?
Not only the character of Superman, but the actor who was chosen.
Well, the actor who played it, we had a discussion on this the other night. I think he's just, if you compare his performance with Christopher Reeves, it plays a little like an imitation with none of the...
Well, they picked someone who looked exactly like...
With none of the personality.
Yeah.
I mean he has the personality of a runway model, and there's no clear delineation between his Clark Kent and his Superman personalities, to the level that Reeve brought to it.
You know who I thought was good in that Super, who I did like, was James Marsden. I thought he was good. I mean, I thought I thought Frank Langella was good, but as a whole, there's something missing.
Well, I think it's the character of Superman. I think we're so accustomed now to our superheroes being inundated with this kind of dark past.
Yeah, dark past.
Yeah,
emo.
With X-Men and Batman, and I think that's the way we want our superheroes now.
And Superman ain't like that.
Superman is a goody-two-shoes. I mean,
that's true.
And Lex Luthor has to be the most boring villain in the history of the history.
Well, played by Kevin Spacey, it's just not. See, that's another thing. I thought Gene Hackman was so good in that part, and Spacey, he just plays it so mean spirited, and so it's like, all right, is this the right movie? I mean,
well, it's not so much that Lex Luthor's a bad character. I didn't mean to put it like that.
Yeah.
I just said the whole foil for Superman being kryptonite.
Right.
It's just so predictable and redundant. There's nothing else. There's not a whisper of surprise in these movies. How are we going to kill Superman? Bring out the kryptonite. I mean, that's Superman 1-6 right there.
I like
also,
the first two a lot.
But isn't there also something to be said for the weird thing they did with, it's kind of a remake, but it's also, it takes place after part 2, and there's
forget about 3, 4, 5. This place. This
yeah.
One
forget about the third and fourth one. It's a third. It's basically the third Superman.
I think that was confusing for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it was confusing for me. I know, and maybe that's what they were trying to. You know, he took off, and no one knew where he was, and he came back, so he was kind of in a dark light.
And everyone's younger.
Right, yeah. So that was very confusing. Maybe they were trying to do the whole, you know, bad guy, the Marvel thing, you know, but it didn't work at all. It was just very out of place, and it
yeah.
didn't work.
No, you're right. It didn't. For me, it was a disappointment when I saw it.
Yeah, I agree. And it was just there's got to be something new. And you could even tell in the old series. I agree. Superman 2 is a superior chapter in the Superman.
Yeah, I like Superman 2 a lot. I won't lie to you.
I do too. It's just it's just a lot of fun, and you have these three villains of equal powers, and that's a real foil for Superman. It seems like they tried to play with that formula somewhat in the sequels. You know, giving him a bad alter ego, and you know the man with the lightning, whatever that last the Quest for Peace thing was.
Oh, that one was ridiculous.
Nuclear man. Or
nuclear.
Whatever.
Oh man, that one was just. Oh my God.
Yes.
But even in the comic books, I think they realized that, you know, in 92 or whatever.
When
they
killed him.
All right, this guy, we can't do this anymore. Kill him. Finish it off. And they immediately reinvented it with all, you know, with Steel and with the other, the alien Superman and all this stuff. And they knew even then that it gets old. Like, people are just, there's nowhere else to take this.
He's a limited character, yeah.
Yeah.
What's the next big comic book film on the horizon?
I think isn't Iron Man one of the?
Oh, that's right.
Oh,
right.
It's definitely Iron Man.
Yeah, Iron Man is, and I think that, you know, going back to Marvel, and I'm with Chris. I'm so with you. Growing up there, you know, where there were no great movies made of Marvel characters really until, you know, if you want to say maybe Blade was the first one that was, but I didn't even know who Blade was from a comic book until like a couple months before the movie came out. I wasn't familiar with Blade, but.
It was a third-tier comic.
Yeah,
what
Singer did with X-Men was incredible, revolutionary, if you will.
Right, and then Spider-Man right on his heels. They really started up, and then we started getting second and third-tier, you know, third.
Hey, we got Ghost Rider, which, you know, I'm not going to. Yeah, my sentiments exactly.
Daredevil.
Ghost Rider, Daredevil, you know, they
Fantastic
and the other
Four.
Blade movies, they started getting a little. I can't go with you on Fantastic Four because people knock that, but actually, Fantastic Four is probably closer to the spirit of that comic book than any other movie.
He's absolutely right.
Well, I mean, does that make it a good film?
Yeah,
I think it does, and
yes,
I think that's
what it does.
That's what was always so great about the Fantastic Four comic book is that it was very wholesome and it was a family comic book. It wasn't like X-Men and Spider-Man and all these things, and it wasn't ever terribly violent. It was more of a family comic book.
And it was one of my favorites. It still is one of my favorites, but it was probably the comic book I most remember from my childhood.
The sequel titles are fun, though. I mean, that's my favorite part.
Yeah.
The Fantastic Four 3. The Fantastic Four 5-6.
Right. 301.
Yeah, I haven't invested a lot of time in the Fantastic. I just recently watched. I think I've pretty much seen both of them all the way, just bits and pieces at a time, but not terribly impressed. But that genre as a whole doesn't really impress
me. Yeah,
no,
you're not into that. You're not.
Yeah,
that's not your cup of tea.
That's why X-Men really is a shocking revelation, because even for people that aren't into that kind of thing, it's just a crazy entertaining movie, you know.
Yeah, even the third one, which was, you know, admittedly not as good as the first two where story and structure are concerned. However, you got to hand it to Brett Ratner. He made, you know, when they switched projects, Brett Ratner made the more entertaining movie. Now, it had its problems, but it wasn't dull. You got to hand it that. At the very least, it was not a dull movie.
Right.
Yeah, he's a great popcorn director. I mean,
yeah.
He's good at that sort of thing.
He is. I mean, he loves that. He's very good. He said his idol is Spielberg, and that's what he wanted to be, a popcorn director, and, you know, he's done that for the most part.
Yeah, yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see if they can keep it up. You know, it's been going on, you know, since, like you say, since Blade. That was 10 years ago or so.
Yeah, about 9, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is the one film, we'll close off on this, what is the one film this fall season that you're most looking forward to? I'll ask you first, Jerry. Hang on.
Okay.
Before you give your answer.
The Paul Thomas Anderson film. Jesus Christ, that's loud. My God, wait, you know, that's not in a recording. You have that in, you're in your basement. You have your drum set.
That's right.
Yeah, no, the Paul Thomas Anderson film,
There Will Be Blood. Which they just showed a 10-minute reel of at Telluride, didn't they?
Yes, I believe it did. Got to say, right now, the most, because I haven't seen anything from him since Punch Drunk Love, and each film I really adore by him, and this one may be the most, not just from a story perspective, but it's about oil, and he might, by going into the past, he's talking about one of the most important things in America right now, oil.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting how that project came about for him, because he said that he felt like the well had run dry, and everything he tried to write, he couldn't follow through on. He didn't feel inspired enough to finish. And so just as a little test, he decided to adapt a scene from that book, Oil.
Right.
And it went well. And so he just kept adapting more scenes, and then became a feature-length script that he was very excited about. And he feels rejuvenated again. He feels like he's working on something else right now, writing something else that is very different from his, you know, he's a very versatile director.
He is.
That's very different from what he's done in the past, and he feels very confident about that as well. So that's it. That's interesting. It's going to be a fantastic movie, and any new performance from Daniel Day-Lewis
is always a reason to celebrate.
Yeah, absolutely. Just one of our great chameleon actors, Daniel Day-Lewis. Chris, what about you? Hang on. You get your own drum roll too, okay?
All right.
You ready? Okay, here we go.
Garfield 3.
Is that the one where he fights the Predator?
Garfield versus Predator. No, oh, wouldn't that be great?
I would pick another novel adaptation, a great novel from two great filmmakers, No Country for Old Men, Coen Brothers.
Oh, that's, yeah.
I think, again, they're normally working with their own material, and I really can't wait to see what they do with this fantastic,
it's a great book.
Cormac McCarthy book. I just finished reading it, and it's just freaking amazing.
Yeah.
Every time I see the preview, I got to go change my shorts and then
tell me about it.
Lay down with an ice pack for a while. And
I'm glad I didn't pick that one. I would have felt like a dork.
Well, I want to see There Will Be Blood too. I think I agree with you. I think it looks fantastic, and I honestly believe that Paul Thomas Anderson's the most promising director, young director that there is. Period.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good choice. I mean, I would have chosen No Country for Old Men too. So now I have to choose something else.
Oh shit.
Okay, get ready. This is a surprising choice, but I'll explain myself. Hang on. Make it first. All right, I'm getting my money's worth on that drum roll. I would choose The Bucket List.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if it'll be a good movie. I mean, Rob Reiner's very hit and miss, but I don't see how it can be anything less than an absolutely enjoyable one. I mean, it seems like on the level of something like As Good As It Gets, just from the subject matter and the cast alone. And those are movies that always, for years afterwards, you can put in if you want to smile. I mean, I know it sounds corny, but As Good As It Gets is one of those movies that just makes me happy when I watch it. And I get the same sense from The Bucket List. And I think, you know, we need more movies.
Do you think
like
Jack will get nominated?
Probably. I mean,
I think he's going to get nominated again.
He could have a bowel movement and get nominated.
That would be quite a bowel.
An Oscar-winning bowel movement. All right, gentlemen. We're 1 minute out from the show time slot being depleted. So it's been an interesting show. Great conversation. Sorry the guest didn't show up tonight, but we have a packed show on Sunday night with two guests back-to-back, and the same for next Wednesday. And we thank everyone out there for listening. And if you have any questions for the Geeks or suggestions of topics for the future, just email us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. Don't forget to subscribe by iTunes. And if you want a Movie Geeks United show of your own on your website, blog page, profile page, just give us an email at the address that I indicated, and we will send you your very own Movie Geeks United player that will automatically upload the latest episodes on your page. So that's pretty cool. All right.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, everyone.
Thank you, guys. Everybody, have a good weekend. We'll see you back here on Sunday.
Okay, good night. Bye-bye.
Bye.